You guys aren't qualified to guard the brains of the local zombie takeout.
Hello and welcome to episode 484 of Zombie Takeout.
Zombie Takeout.
The B-Movie and Cult Movie Show. I'm John.
And hello, I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's movie, we need to talk about the Munsters trailer. Rob Zombie has done a Munsters film. There's a trailer floating around. Actually, they just released a second trailer today.
And it's strange because a lot of the commenters apparently are not familiar with the Munsters.
Yeah. And they expected it to be like what Rob Zombie normally does.
Yes. They were expecting Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and they got the Munsters.
And I initially thought it was a fucking train wreck, but then I watched the trailers a couple more times and remembered what the Munsters was, and
yeah,
it actually really fits it.
Yeah, it's you know, he's not doing anything new with it, really, which is kind of weird.
Yeah.
Setting up the, you know, I guess a prequel, a Munsters prequel, which I don't know if we ever really needed, what the hell.
It's about how Lily and Herman got together and how Grandpa was very much against it. He didn't think Herman was good enough. I can't get used to, I mean, the actor they picked for Grandpa is fine, but I can't get used to him with a mustache.
I can't get used to Herman's voice. I mean, they really should have thrown as much money at Brad Garrett as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
And this would have been like, oh my God, I'm going to see this. But now I'm like, we'll probably review it.
And I was thinking about this, actually, long before I saw the trailer, when we reviewed The Watcher, there's that opening scene with Keanu awkwardly dancing in slow motion to Dragula.
Yeah.
And, you know, while watching it, my ADHD took over and I looked up the lyrics to Dragula. They're not really worth reading. and then I'm like, what's Dragula? I found out the Munster's car is called Dragula.
Okay.
It's that, you know, hot rod hearse. Yeah. So apparently Rob Zombie has had a fixation on the Munsters. You know, he's a little older than us, so probably grew up with it.
I mean, I watched it all the time. Yeah. When it was in reruns as a kid.
Incidentally, the movie, the Rob Zombie's Munsters, straight to video.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Everything's straight to video, almost.
Well, it's going to first be released, I think, September 27th, I want to say, late September, on Blu-ray and DVD, and I think streaming, like, for rental, and then it's going to Netflix. It's not getting a theatrical release, which is very interesting.
It shouldn't, anyway. It's a TV show, you know?
Yeah, yeah. The last Munsters film, the one with Jerry O'Connell and Eddie Izzard.
Oh, my God.
I thought that was kind of okay.
I don't know that, I don't know if I was aware that existed.
I thought it was from, like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. I looked it up today. It was 2012.
So wait a minute. Jerry O'Connell's Herman?
As Herman, Eddie Izzard is
Izzard's grandpa.
Yeah. I don't think anybody else was particularly memorable in terms of the cast.
Was I in a coma back then?
I don't know. This? So I think, and my position is completely 180'd on this, but I think I'm actually going to check it out when it hits Netflix.
I'm thinking we need to do a back-to-back Munsters review. A two-parter.
For the NBC Jerry O'Connell one and then the new one?
Oh, was that a TV movie?
Yeah, it was on NBC.
That's probably why I didn't know about it then.
Yeah. That one, maybe. Ooh. I know there was a 60s one movie with the original cast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's not watchable.
No? Okay, I was thinking of three-parter, a trilogy.
None of these could be watchable.
The 2012 one was okay. You know, nothing particularly great, but it was fine. I didn't, you know, I wasn't cringing.
Although, honestly, let's think about this. So, The Munsters, it's a good show. The plot's barely held, though, for a half hour.
It was a 60s sitcom. They all had the same plots.
I can't see it holding up for an hour and a half. And God help if they did 2 hours.
It's straight to video, so I'm sure it's like, you know, an hour and a half, maybe an hour 20, if you know, if Zombie understands his job, it'll be short. I don't know. I think if you go in with the right perspective and the right expectations, it could be a lot of fun. Maybe we'll review it.
Right. It was just really funny seeing commenters going, I can't, it's so campy. What's going on here? And it's like, it's the Munsters.
I haven't seen an episode of the Munsters since I was a kid. And when I saw it, I was like, oh shit, this is a train wreck. This looks horrible. It took me a minute to realize, like, no, this is what the Munsters was.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, should be fun. Anyway, on to this week's movie, which is from 1974, Freebie and the Bean. This is the first part of a James Caan tribute two-parter, and this one was recommended to us by Bodo.
Wow, this was quite a week. It was kind of like what just happened?
Best of times, worst of times, honestly.
I spent the entire week for both shows just like, wait, what's going on here?
And of course that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by Morality. Aren't you glad it isn't what it used to be?
Also brought to you by Slapstick Violence. Watch the creation for a blueprint for billions of dollars in box office business for 50 years and counting.
Kind of feel like that was the Keystone Cops, but
oh no, I mean, well,
there's a lot of Keystone Cops in
this. I think they were just doing flat-out slapstick, whereas this was slapstick, and then six people died back
there. Yeah, okay, fair point.
All right.
It was slapstick by way of Scorsese.
Something like that, yeah. So we have these two cops rooting through trash to begin the film, and they come across pretty much the golden key to make a case against this mobster they've been tracking forever. And they need to get the witness, and then they've got an airtight case to send him away. They can finally do it. And, there's just a problem. Somebody has decided to put a contract out on this mob boss, and apparently the mob boss has really shitty security. Because, instead of letting nature take its course and just let the mobster get killed, which would have saved everybody so much heartache and lives and stuff, they instead try to protect the mob boss so they can be the heroes and get their promotions and get on with their lives, pretty much. So they go to protect the mob boss. They kind of half smart idea of bringing him in on a trumped up charge. The problem, of course, with this plan, that they don't mention that his lawyers could easily get him off for harassment if they bring him in on a trumped up charge.
Although if harassment was really an issue in this universe, those two would have lost their badges long ago.
True. But I guess if you get a good enough lawyer at any time period, you know, if you've got the money back, then you totally could have made that case.
Yeah, the mob boss had the lawyer, could get a lawyer to do it, who could pull it off.
Because also when they brought him in, the DA was screaming at them about, you know, the lieutenant governor being on the phone and with them, and just, you know, he was a respected member of the business community at the same time as being the mob boss.
He was a mob boss.
Right. He was one of those mob bosses. I mean, there's, you know, different types.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But he cared about his legit image and his, you know, cracked crabs and, you know, whatnot. So instead, they're put on him to tail him and to protect him. Sort of like a Hogan's Heroes kind of thing, where, you know, they've got to protect the criminal for some reason to get the plot going. And there's several hit attempts, and they're still looking for that one witness, and they find out he was out of town, he was coming in, and all of this with the backdrop. And I think this might have been the first time someone's used this, but this football game called the Super Bowl. Which was only about 8 years old at the time.
Okay.
I think it's the first time it was ever actually, like the backdrop of a pop culture
Okay,
event.
that's novel.
And of course, the climax, the last hit attempt winds up there in the ladies' room, and lots of car crashes and hilarity ensues.
Alan Arkin commented in the December 23rd, 1974 issue of People magazine that he only acted in the film because he needed a paycheck, but felt that it was absolute garbage.
I had heard, like, this is one of the first times, well, one of the few times, I guess, where I had to like look stuff up on this, because this is just bananas, this movie. That's another way of putting it around. This is just insane.
You retained a lot more of the plot than I did, and the only reason I retained any of that is because I paused the movie halfway through and read the Wikipedia summary, because I was not getting it from the movie.
It well, I mean, the car chases do kind of thin the plot out, but there's so much to unpack here. I think this is also like one of the first real buddy cop movies. Like,
Well,
it kind
although,
of.
is it a buddy cop movie?
Yes.
Because half the time they get along great, and half the time Freevee, Khan's character, is just a raging racist. And Arkin's character is Latinx.
Right. And that, man, you almost, I wish I had a camera on me while watching this, like a reaction video. Because when I found out that the bean, what the bean was,
Oh, I didn't even put that together. Wow.
I almost did a spit take because I had no idea. I
Yeah, I
was
think.
going in, just innocent 2022. And it was like, wait, he's the bean
I
because he's
think
Mexican?
they do specifically say he's Mexican at one point.
Yes, and they specifically draw it out. That's why he's the bean.
Oh, God.
He's the beaner. It's like, oh my God.
And you have Alan Arkin and Valerie Harper, his wife, playing Latinx, Mexican.
Yeah, I mean,
Harper won a Golden Globe or got a Golden Globe nomination for this. And her character is just called Bean's wife. She has like two scenes. I mean, she's fine, but she basically got nominated for speaking very quickly in Spanish and doing a halfway decent, generic Latinx accent.
it's really, I mean, it's very stereotypical, Latino, Latina behavior, the whole jealous lover thing going on here. And then I realized, you know what? For 1974, in their warped view, this was progressive.
Probably.
This was considered progressive, because think about this, Arkin, being white, playing it never occurred to them to actually have the race portray the
And
race
someone who's
back then.
Mexican play Mexican.
Right, it was just beyond their comprehension. But having them represented in the story somehow, even not directly represented by an actor to do it, what was considered progressive, and the fact that he's like this family man, and but yeah, a lot of it was just the weird interrogation scene, which, damn, that was creepy.
From a 2022 perspective, it's like if someone went back in time and tried to make the most problematic movie they could.
Yeah, the people, of course, talk PC and this and that, but just thinking about how much domestic violence and cops and that whole scene was just like, ugh. And then, the fact that he was talking about going into the hotel room and just killing him, and just, I mean, that was all like, man, I know they were just being lighthearted back then, but yikes.
On the positive side, I like that they don't set up the partnership. There's no origin story of like, oh, we gotta work together.
Right.
And there's no setup for the opening scene where they're stealing garbage.
Well, yeah, I figured out they were just sleuthing, trying to get clues.
And Khan and Arkin did have great chemistry.
God, yes. Fantastic chemistry between the two.
Although I realized watching this that Paul Reiser ripped his whole shtick off from Alan Arkin.
Yeah.
I've never noticed that before.
There, this so much stemmed from this movie. I'd say good and bad. But I mean, I just did a list of like the different buddy cop movies that you know obviously took this blueprint and ran with it. Maybe the Blues Brothers, of course, too.
This probably was a big influence on the Blues Brothers.
From what I understand, this started out as an actual drama.
Yeah, prior to filming, director Richard Rush, who incidentally directed Color of Night, which you've seen it?
Yes. Well, I've seen a scene.
You fast-forwarded through it like the rest of us, yes. really only known for, you know, lots of nudity from Jane March when she was in her prime, and a frontal nude scene from Bruce Willis. Really all the movie is known for it or worth. He directed that. Where was I going? Oh, right. Prior to filming, director Richard Rush worked on the script with Con Arkin and screenwriter Robert Kaufman in several improv sessions. Rush said, at my suggestion, they turned what had originally been a serious drama into a bizarre comedy. Slowly, their relationship took on the pains and pleasures of a friendship neither could live with or without. Arkin admits that Rush's ideas turned the film into a comedy, saying, quote, I hadn't thought about it. I didn't see it in the script.
Well, here's why that was actually the right thing to do. Because this movie had already pretty much been done already, plot-wise. You know, Dirty Harry was, you know, a big part of being set in San Francisco. There was another cop movie even before this that had similar plot elements too. This was kind of a tired out cop movie. Mm-hmm. And then to just say, well, we'll take that and do some improvising and obvious punching up and turning it into a comedy.
Punching up in the comedy writer sense, in the script doctor sense.
Yes.
Because it's a lot of punching down in the other sense.
Well, yes.
Just the casual police brutality, even just at the taco stand. They're at this taco stand to get some information from the guy, you know, who runs the place. And they see, you know, a local criminal. And they just walk over to him and pour his drink all over him and walk away.
I was worried it was, like, coffee, but then I realized it wasn't.
Who said it? Again, going with the few positives, I like how they talk to each other. It's very natural. They just kind of talk over each other.
Yeah.
Could have done without the Love and Spoonful sound-alike opening theme.
it doesn't fit with the movie at all.
And the argument at the construction site, and even all of the arguments between them, kind of come out of nowhere.
Well,
like they're getting along real well, and suddenly they start screaming at each other.
Well, except when somebody does something like hides their gun, and
and as does Khan's casual racism, it just kind of picks up out of nowhere a lot.
You could tell they were really going. In fact, they even spelled it out that they were going for Archie Bunker with the badge.
Yeah, they mentioned Archie Bunker. Yeah. Like, are we supposed to be rooting for them?
I mean, the point is that they are corrupt cops, or at least Khan is.
Yeah. And I, on one level, I can kind of appreciate, like, morally dubious leads. But then to make it a comedy, ostensibly, and have them, you know, win in the end with no repercussions just seems odd.
I think it took me a while to get what they were doing here. And it really came down to the Super Bowl. That and the setting of this in San Francisco, which both of these things are pretty much summing up what's going on in America at the time. Now, hear me out, because it's you know, there's a lot of chase scenes that, you know, there's people just hanging out in the park, there's art installations, and they're like the bulls in the china shop just wrecking all of these things. But the Super Bowl is practically a character of the film. It's talked about in almost every scene. And by the way, the Super Bowl has never been played in San Francisco proper.
Oh, interesting.
It's been in the suburbs a couple times, one of them being 2016, one of them being Stanford in the mid-80s.
The Niners never played in San Francisco proper?
The Niners played at Candlestick Park, but they never had a Super Bowl there.
Oh, because I remember they went, they played in the Super Bowl a couple times. They never hosted.
The closest they got was when they were in Stanford.
Okay.
Which was, relative, close-ish, and that other time was Santa Clara, was in 2016, but they've never played in Candlestick Park.
Oh. Okay.
Which is where they filmed. So why do that? Why have the city that's never hosted a Super Bowl and never will, really? And that climactic scene with the cheering of the Super Bowl game and this, it's really about America's love of violence, It's taking the obsession with the Super Bowl and this guy who should be worried about his life, and instead they're talking about the dumb game. And then putting this violent fight scene at the end with the drumming and the cheering and stuff. And I think that's what they were going for. This whole thing about slapstick with real violence, and you've got Arkin trying to call in people because you're laughing, and then he's there to remind us that six people just died back there.
And maybe all the other problematic stuff was also more a social commentary more than just problematic bullshit.
I think so. And if they did this in a drama setting, they would never have gotten away with it. Would have been so heavy-handed and so whatever. But doing this as a comedy...
You might be talking me up.
Doing this as a comedy... I might be the first critic to pull this out of it in years.
I will say there were some positives. This might be my first time seeing Loretta Swit in a different role, which was interesting.
There were so many surprises at the beginning. It was like, that's why Bean is named. Here's Major Houlihan. Yeah.
The best part of the movie for me, Alex Rocco.
Alex Rocco,
the police chief.
Best
angry
DA or the police chief.
I he was the one who was yelling at them. In one scene. I think I just took it as the police chief because he kind of played that role. Best angry police chief I've seen. I love Alex Rocco. He's brilliant in anything. So, I also enjoyed the car crashing into the elderly couple's apartment. That was a nice stunt.
And the. Just them being deadpan and him calling for a tow truck on the third floor.
Yeah. I have a note about, realizing halfway through the movie that they're the butt of the joke. And actually that does play into your idea. Because, if they're the butt of the joke, they should get punished at the end. But with your interpretation, that makes sense.
And, they had no repercussions for what they did. Mm-hmm. But they also had no... advancement for what they did either.
Right.
No reward nor penalty.
They really didn't sell the fight by the fountain. Preeby and Bean just beat the shit out of each other by this fountain. Maybe they should have hired stunt performers instead of having the actors do it, but
I think they spent all their money on stunt doubles for that motorcycle scene.
Yeah.
that was supposed to be Khan on that motorcycle for most of that.
Another scene that kind of leans into your interpretation, the bathroom shooting.
Oh, yeah.
Visually spectacular, but horrifying.
I loved them getting armed up for that, too. Just this crazy arsenal that they're coming in. And I'm sort of thinking, why wouldn't they just stand behind the door and wait for him to come out of the men's room and just get him from behind there?
Yeah, exactly. Instead of being, subtle about it and, effective, they just went for the spectacular, four guns through the door.
They almost fucked the whole thing up, too. Yeah. Like, the bullet going out into the stall.
Yeah.
And only because he dropped his gun going for it. It's the only reason why they were still alive.
Now, there's a line in the movie about a vice cop making $50 a week working a bowling alley. Was that a living wage in 74?
Oof, I don't know.
It couldn't
well,
have
it's,
been.
Well, it's probably just on top of
on
his
top
cop
of
salary.
His salary, yeah.
You know, just a nice bonus.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, in addition to the casual racism and brutality, there was also quite a bit of homophobia, a bit of transphobia at the end.
I mean, they had one, they kind of had a surprise with that, though. That the, well, I guess we'll get to that with the
ending.
We've
yeah.
talked about the climax or fight scene already, but we'll get to it some more.
Mm-hmm. I did appreciate this the line about Bean actually believing that vibrators are facial massagers.
Oh.
I did get a kick out of that. But, you know, as spectacular as these, you know, car crash scenes were, these set pieces, they kind of just felt plugged in.
Yeah.
You know, and the motorcycle chase you mentioned, very Keystone Cops.
It's ridiculous. That's one of the most ridiculous scenes of the film. Mm. Just the going over cars up and down like that.
And then, like, about three quarters of the way through, we get this, I'm going to say 20-minute scene of just Bean and his wife arguing because he thought she was cheating on him.
Oh, yeah.
Completely out of nowhere.
Both of their spouse scenes, I get they were trying to do some character building, and I think the actors were demanding that. But yeah. Neither scene really belonged to this movie.
The director of Color of Night.
Well, I think he was indulging them because they wanted to act more and they were upset that the stunts were, you know, taking the tension from them.
One of the sponsors I decided not to go with before we started recording was directing. It's just not for everybody. I was caught off guard when Bean was shot. Probably the only surprise in the movie. And then it gets kind of all serious before, you know, the ending comedy bit.
Well, right. It feels like it kind of felt like they were echoing to Brian's song.
Yeah. Well, and not just the shooting, but then the whole, like, kind of wrapping up of everything gets all serious.
Yeah. That they were just being used to the whole thing in the end anyway. Right. They were just bit players, really. They're almost a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern.
Yeah, sort of. And of course the bathroom scene, I can't decide if it was homophobic or transphobic. There's a twist where, you know, a character turns out to be a guy in drag.
The surprise, of course, at least for that time, is that she beats the shit out of Keeps Gone.
Yeah, true.
I mean, and effortlessly, too.
Yeah.
Like, but the whole choreography and score to that, and it's really weird. It's one of the weirdest fight scenes I think we've ever seen in this show. And just the whole washing the hands after, like, just beating the shit out of him, and then him trying to take her again, and she sweeps the leg. Just like, if he hadn't gotten his gun, he was not going to win that fight.
Right. And of course it ends with another set piece because it's this movie.
Yeah.
I don't see a need for sequels or remakes.
I read there was,
oh no,
there was a TV series.
Actually happened or was planned?
It happened. And it only lasted maybe like 6 episodes around 80-81 on
different
CBS.
Different actors, I'm assuming.
Hector Alonso.
Okay, better choice.
As the Bean. Some other dude as Freebie. Uh-huh. Oh, we never said Freebie, of course. The reason why he's called that is because he shakes everybody down, all businesses down for like a discount. Hence the nickname Freebie.
Right.
And they were talking sequel back in the day because this, against all odds, was considered a hit.
Okay. I had read that it was a bit of a disappointment, but in terms of box office, but maybe.
But the only reason I think a sequel never got made was because Arkin wanted to direct.
Oh. Okay.
And I mean, if you're not getting Rush back to do it, it just this doesn't go, you know? Because how different would an Arkhan-directed movie be
Probably would have been better.
as opposed to this
Yeah,
chaos?
true, true.
I mean, it kind of worked for him and against him, the chaos of this. It was very like, wait, what?
I have to admit, I'm a bit curious about the series now.
Yeah, because they couldn't have done half the stuff. Even 6 or 7 years later, they couldn't have done half the stuff they were doing in this. And of course, this was for the theaters and not the TV, which was super uptight back then.
Right. Underbrains.
On to brains.
You talked me up a bit. Initially, I was going to say half a brain for the set pieces, half a brain for the chemistry between Khan and Arkhan, and a brain for Rocco. I'm adding a brain because it may have been way smarter than I gave it credit for, maybe. So I'm going three.
Pretty close. I enjoyed it. I wouldn't recommend it because, well, I want to keep my job and stuff. No, it's it's a jumbled, chaotic mess, and I think that loading up scene, young Quentin Tarantino definitely saw.
Oh yeah, I read on Wikipedia that Tarantino calls it a masterpiece. He has weird tastes. I mean, I like some of his movies, but the movies he likes tend to be very odd.
So I'm going 3.5.
All right,
This
and what have we learned?
started it all. I learned hookers are very big on fruit.
And I learned that we should have done an Alex Rocco tribute. He died in
Oh,
2015, and we both totally missed it, and I'm a fan.
yeah.
Anyway, that's it for Freebie and the Bean. Until next time, we'll be continuing the tribute two-parter with Bottle Rocket, Wes Anderson's first movie, if I recall correctly.
Something completely different.
Hopefully, way better.
I think we're at the opposite ends of the spectrum.
There Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
you are.